Hello and welcome to Iceberg Ahead. Today we want to speak about COVID, farmer and politics. With me in studio today is Dr. Peter McCullough. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We're really blessed to have you here. Give me a short introduction to you. Dr. Peter McCullough is an internist, cardiologist and epidemiologist, with degrees from Baylor University, University of Texas Southwestern Medical School, University of Michigan and Southern Methodist University. He treats infectious disease and cardiovascular complications of viral infections and following COVID-19 vaccination in Dallas, Texas, United States. Dr. McCullough has published numerous professional publications and has spoken out in various media on the medical response to the COVID-19 crisis. He's considered one of the world's leading experts on COVID-19 and has testified before various panels on many aspects of pandemic response. Well, I'm glad that you join us for this interview. There are a lot of questions that I want to ask you. The first thing I would like to know, speaking about the COVID-19 and the spike protein, is a coronavirus some kind of new virus the medicals have to face nowadays?
You know, it actually fits with the name of the show, Iceberg Ahead, right? And is there another iceberg ahead? Before the pandemic, it was known that there was about 4 beta coronaviruses that could cause the common cold. Common cold is also caused by paramyxovirus, adenovirus, Coxsackie viruses, a whole variety of rhinovirus. These are common viruses. So there were 4 beta coronaviruses, and it was known that they are as infectious as any other common cold. What happened, though, and what we've learned, is that a human beta coronavirus was made in a chimeric form, a merging with a bat coronavirus, in order to design it to invade the human body.
Well, if you say a bat coronavirus, you mean is a coronavirus from a bat or it's a bad one?
No, a bat. Really, from a bat, from a bat that flies, yes. Ah. And so all this has been learned through review of publications. Ralph Baric as the senior author, Vineet Minichary as first author, 2016, Nature Medicine and Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They published papers that said that a bat coronavirus is poised for human emergence. And in those papers, they describe a collaboration between the U.S. researchers, the U.S. National Institutes of Health, an NGO, the EcoHealth Alliance, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, the Chinese, Dr. Shengling Li, and that collaboration produced the chimeric. They actually produced this artificial virus, this man-made engineered virus that was more infectious and clearly capable to invade the body and be lethal, where prior coronaviruses were benign.
Uh-huh. I mean, I'm sure he did this for a purpose. Is there any reason to fit these two viruses together?
Many have opined on this, and I can tell you on the National Security Administration, the Department of State, the CIA, the FBI, Department of Energy, on their websites, they all say that SARS-CoV-2 is not a bioweapon. They say it's not a bioweapon. Well, the question is, what is it then? What do they characterize as? Was this just for the sake of science? Why was the kind of research biological threat unit of the National Institutes of Health involved, called BARDA? Why was the research unit of the US military involved, DARPA? My interpretation is, I think this was research designed in terms of biological threat, that this could be a biological threat, and to understand it and then come up with responses, including monoclonal antibodies, therapeutics, and vaccines. So there's threat and countermeasure, threat and countermeasure. And that's a theme of the research that is basically curried by the EcoHealth Alliance. They're an NGO led by Peter Daszak. He's received more research funding recently from the NIH to do more work with bat coronaviruses. In this case, now he's taken the work to Duke University in Singapore instead of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So this is big business. There is this work going on in what's called biolabs. Mm-hmm. And in the origins of SARS-CoV-2, many were involved. The French played a big role, for instance. The Wuhan Institute of Virology was a biosecurity level 3 lab. It meant that it had some security measures, but not very high. And the French company bioMérieux, at the time led by Stéphane Bancel, who's now the CEO of Moderna, he led a 4-year period of time for bioMérieux, where bioMérieux received the contract from the Chinese to build the biosecurity level 4 annex in Wuhan, China. So the CEO of Moderna was actually working with the Chinese to build this lab, and then later on he writes patents for vaccines against SARS-CoV-2 before the pandemic ever started.
That sounds pretty scary. It sounds like a conspiracy behind. But
well, listen, you said the word. Now, are you a conspiracy theorist for saying that? I would say no.
Well, I would say no.
I would say that what you did is you made a statement that tells me that you're a rational theorist. A rational theorist is someone who comes up with a rational inference based on what you're told. It's not a conspiracy theory. You're a rational theorist because your theories, as you construct them and as I construct them, are rational, reasonable, testable, debatable. We can discuss them. Right? We shouldn't be afraid to discuss this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, conspiracy theory is today so a bad word, huh? but it's just a theory. It can be or not. We need to prove it.
Well, we should be rational theorists.
Absolutely.
It doesn't even... But when you talk about conspiring or collaboration, there's no doubt about it. The papers by Ralph Baric said they were working with the National Institutes of Health, the EcoHealth Alliance, the Chinese, the Wuhan Institute of Virology. They are collaborating. Even vaccine developer Peter Hotez in Houston, he has grants in 2016 with the National Institutes of Health and Fudan University in China, Dr. Jian, for SARS-CoV-2 biodefense grants. Biodefense. So the word biodefense is used in 2016. So I think it's reasonable. You asked what is SARS-CoV-2. I could say at least reasonably it is a biological threat. I think that's fair to say. And that people are working on strategies to defend it. So it was created. It's man-made. It is a chimeric, as the literature tells us. And then everything we've done to it, we've tried to respond to it.
Well, may I ask, is there anything special in these SARS-CoV-2, and where is it from? You say it's man-made, this virus, and you say parts are from a bat, parts are from a human virus, and they fit it together. What makes this new virus now so special that it's so different than the other?
What makes it so special is the spike protein on the surface of the virus. So everyone knows the virus has a nucleocapsid, that's the ball. And then the spines on the surface of the virus, that's what makes it so special. So they have a designer feature to them where they can lock into a human receptor on a human cell, an ACE2 receptor. And that's what Baric and Menacheri and the Chinese showed in the 2016 papers, that the spike protein will lock into the human ACE2 receptor, then the virus can inject itself right into the cell. And then once it invades, then it gets on the other side, it goes into the bloodstream. When you get a common cold, the virus is not in the bloodstream. SARS-CoV-2 infection relatively quickly gets into the bloodstream unless we can stop it in the nose and mouth. So that's the difference. The difference is the spike protein. There's roughly just under 30 proteins known in the virus. But out of all the proteins, the most important one that's potentially lethal is the spike protein.
And what will happen if a spike protein now connects to a human cell? And what happens then when the door is open once?
The virus goes inside, it's able to install itself, and then replicate. And then the virus replicates, destroys the cell, and then you know, a single virus particle can turn into thousands as that cell explodes and then the virus goes. It's like a seed spreading out into the air.
Mm-hmm. So it has a kind of mRNA or DNA in it, this virus?
Virus is RNA.
RNA. Uh-huh. And this will then multiply in the cell.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If I would ask you, if you would infect with, or if you are infected by COVID-19, how would you cure yourself? If this is once gone, if this is once in your cell, what to do then?
Late 2019, people were getting sick in China. Early 2020, in Milan, Italy, the EU, here in Germany, elsewhere, people started to get sick with the virus. That's before there's any vaccines. The human body forms immunity. In a paper by Hakim and colleagues, Hakim showed that the human body forms immunity to at least 15 of the proteins of the virus. And the immunity involves cells, T cells, B cells that actually physically fight the virus, natural killer cells that destroy the virus, and antibodies. But antibodies are more passive. They have to actually connect through mucus or through the blood or other body fluids. So we really rely on our cellular immunity. Our nasal passages in our mouth are full of immune cells. We know this because we have lymph nodes. We can actually feel our lymph nodes. There is a circle of tonsils and adenoids in the back of the throat. It's called Waldeyer's ring. Waldeyer's ring protects us. And the T cells, B cells that are in the nasopharynx protect us. So cellular immunity, I think, is probably more important than the antibody-based immunity. There's been such a focus on antibodies, but they've been a false surrogate for immunity.
Mm-hmm. So when I would come to your doctor's office and I would say, I have the problem, I've COVID-19 positive tested, mm-hmm. What can I do now? Is there any way I can help myself?
That was the very first unmet need. So I had dedicated all of my previous research team and staff and resources when the pandemic hit in 2020 towards that exact question. What can someone do to avoid two bad outcomes, hospitalization and death? Those you have the illness, you don't want to be hospitalized, and you don't want to die. If you had it at home and you got through it, you'd think, okay, that's a favorable outcome. So early in 2020, I worked with Italian colleagues, U.S. colleagues, and we published the first treatment protocol of what to do at the moment one is diagnosed with COVID-19 at home in the ambulatory world and not waiting until the hospitalization. So the first point is never wait till hospitalization to begin treatment. Well, we wouldn't do that for any community pneumonia, any other illness anyway. The second point is risk stratification. Young people like you that are fit and strong, no treatment in generally is needed. But older individuals, those with medical problems, heart and lung problems, obesity, diabetes, heart and kidney disease, cancer, different risk profile there. So we do risk stratification. Roughly 75% of people need no treatment, none. But 25% of adults do. The first steps that we do, and this would apply to everybody before we get into the prescription medications, is everybody should get fresh air, should not stay in a small apartment breathing the air because we want to actually diffuse the virus and not keep rebreathing it. So that's very important, reduction of reinoculation. The second thing is everyone should use virucidal nasal sprays and gargles. Probably the most important part of our show today. Mm-hmm. The virus is in the nose and mouth replicating. If you let that go for 5 days, it could invade the body. So we now have nasal sprays and gargles. You can even make them at home that are clearly efficacious. 17 studies, 3 high-quality randomized trials show dilute iodine, povidone iodine, dilute xylitol, colloidal silver, peroxide, all of them work. Even in children, dilute baby shampoo works. Salt water works. Conventional gargles like Scope or Listerine. But probably the best is iodine, a few drops of iodine in a spray bottle of water, spray it up the nose, sniff it back, spit it out, do it twice on each side, and then a 30-second gargle. That can be done twice a day to prevent COVID-19, and should be done at the instant a sore throat is felt or nose, at the very instant, even before a test, I would do it. Do it right away, and then every 4 hours when sick. That's very important. Then we move into over-the-counter various agents that can be very helpful. Aspirin, vitamin C, vitamin D at high doses, quercetin, and we have over-the-counter famotidine, which is now really proven to use in the United States. That's wonderful. After that, we get into a layer of dedicated antivirals. For a long time, we relied on hydroxychloroquine, then ivermectin, Paxlovid, which is available in most countries, and molnupiravir. Those are oral antivirals. We add oral antibiotics because there is a superimposed bacterial process going on. Doxycycline, azithromycin. Beyond that, very importantly, a couple days into it, steroids, inhaled budesonide. Very strong data supporting that. 3 randomized trials. Clearly reduces symptoms, reduces the risk of hospitalization and death. Oral steroids save lives. So we use oral prednisolone or dexamethasone. Oral colchicine, been proven in randomized trials to reduce inflammation, particularly the pleural pericardial symptoms and inflammation. And then importantly, blood thinners. We know that this spike protein, one of the reasons why it's lethal, is it promotes blood clotting. So people need blood thinners. The mildest blood thinner is aspirin, but we add others. The prescription blood thinners we use are injectable low molecular weight heparin like enoxaparin or oral antithrombotics like apixaban, rivaroxaban, or dabigatran. But that gives you an idea. So there is what's called the McCullough Protocol. This was the first protocol ever published, August of 2020, that in a sense changed the world. Before this, the belief was there was no treatment for COVID-19, and now we do. To give credit, Dr. Didier Rialt in France was working on a protocol and published hydroxychloroquine-based, Vladimir Zelenko in Western, in upstate New York, and Dr. Merrick and Dr. Corey for the FLCC group. So we all came up with different protocols, but same concepts.
You know, this is, for me, it's good to hear, to have one of the most famous doctors in the world sitting here next to me and show me that there is a treatment against it. Because the first thing that I heard is when the pandemic broke out, they say there's no treatment, better lock in at home, wear a mask. This was the first thing that I saw on the television.
Did that make sense to you?
Well, for me, it never really made sense, but I never heard this as a good treatment out there.
But is there any infection that we would say, listen, let it get really severe before you're hospitalized? If you had a skin infection or any other infection, one would never let it become so severe. So the question you may ask is, well, does it work? Does all this, you know, 4 to 6 drugs? And when we analyze all the studies, and at the time we published the paper, there's about 1,400 studies. The first author is Gugliakalis. I'm the senior author. We knew by December of 2020, we had clear and convincing evidence that multi-drug therapy was working. Now, it wasn't reliant on any single drug, and all the trials were small and non-conclusive. But in aggregate, the drugs used together were working. But it wasn't all resting on the shoulders of hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or Paxlovid. It was actually using drugs together. No drug was necessary nor sufficient, but we needed the multi-drug protocol. The one that I worked on ultimately was U.S. copyrighted. It's called the McCullough Protocol, so it's easy to remember.
Easy, yeah. Thank you. Well, it was extreme early, right after the upcoming of the virus, some vaccines entered the market. Are there any other medications who entered the market similar fast like the vaccines? When I remember, there was, I think it was 2020, that the first vaccines came out. This was directly after the virus came up. So normally I thought that to bring out a vaccine takes longer. Was there anything that came out that early, any treatment, any medication?
There was. Operation Warp Speed in the United States promoted research of not only vaccines, but therapeutics. So before the vaccines, bamlanivimab came out, which was an intravenous monoclonal antibody. It was safe and effective, and I used it in my practice. Later on, a whole variety of monoclonal antibodies came out, but they were ahead of the vaccines. But the vaccines, you're right, came out in record time. U.S. regulations say it takes 2 years to study the safety of a vaccine. These came out after 2 months of a clinical trial period and a 1 month of an observation. And shortcutting the time to observe for safety problems is a huge mistake.
And I remember there were many voices initially warned against the vaccinations. What do we know now after 3 years? Would you promote or reject the vaccinations with the knowledge that you have today?
You know, I was the only public figure in the world who published a major opinion editorial piece in a major journal, and I published it in The Hill, which is a widely read U.S. journal, read by congressmen, senators, the White House, people at the White House. And the title of my op-ed in August of 2020, before the vaccine trials were published, was The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Program. I said it was a gamble because we're throwing all of our resources towards a single approach that was mass vaccination. We've never had a vaccination in the arm that ever really impacted respiratory illnesses very well. And on top of that, the vaccines were genetic. They were largely genetic. They were genetic code. People have never received genetic injections ever in the history of mankind, that this was going to be done for the first time. And to make matters worse, the genetic code was for the lethal part of the virus, the spike protein. So the question is, if we install the genetic code, how long is it going to be producing spike protein? What about the content? How do we shut off the genetic code? None of those questions had answers.
That means you could even take another part from the protein or from the virus to multiply, and they choose a spike protein, so the most lethal part, you say?
Well, partly because if the spike protein could be neutralized, the theory was the virus could not enter the body or could not cause damage, so I understand that selection. But you're right, what about a multivalent vaccine with antigens being the nucleocapsid, the envelope protein, various other types of replicative enzymes. But to select the most lethal part of the virus and have the genetic code go into the human body without knowing where it's going to go in the human body, and the selection of lipid nanoparticles, I think, was a terrible selection. So messenger RNA loaded on lipid nanoparticles, which is what Pfizer and Moderna is, those lipid nanoparticles were known to go everywhere in the body. So can you imagine lipid nanoparticles proven? There's a paper by Wang and colleagues from China that showed that years before, lipid nanoparticles are going to go into the brain, the heart, the reproductive organs, all over the body, and install the genetic code for the potentially lethal protein. It's the worst idea ever.
Well, today in 2023, we have a lot of sick people. They have various illnesses, and some say it's because of the COVID-19. Now, the question is, do vaccinations cause the same health harms as COVID-19, or do the symptoms or disease differ?
The COVID-19 vaccines are the most dangerous and lethal vaccines ever in human history, ever. Let's take the U.S. reporting system, vaccine event reporting system. We've had it since 1990. About half of Americans take vaccines every year, flu vaccines. This is a huge number of people. The number of deaths that's ever reported in that system per year is roughly 150 before COVID. That system has recorded over 30,000 deaths after COVID-19 vaccines. Not 150, 30,000. And if we restrict it just to Americans, which is around half of the VAERS system because other countries use it, just Americans in domestic U.S. territories, that number is now 18,015 Americans. 18,015 Americans have died after the vaccine in the VAERS system. 1,100 Americans, they die right in the vaccine center or the pharmacy or a few minutes or a few hours later. We've never seen this. Our CDC VSAFES data, which is 10 million individuals, it was released. It's on the ICON NGO website to review. 7.7% of Americans who take the shot get so sick in the next few minutes or hours, they have to go to the emergency department or be hospitalized. There's a paper actually out today in the U.S. literature on healthcare workers. And this study shows that of healthcare workers, largely nurses who take the shot, a third of them can't go to work the next day, they're so sick. We've never had a vaccine that has this much acute toxicity, ever.
Mm-hmm. That brings me directly to the next question. You know, some people today, they suffer from a disease, they call it long COVID, despite multiple vaccinations. What do we know about it? How can we help these people?
We're learning a lot more about it. Before the vaccines in 2020, there were cases of long COVID, or it was called post-COVID syndrome or post-acute sequelae syndrome. They're all synonyms. And they were largely among people sick enough to be hospitalized. About 50% of people sick enough to be hospitalized could have persistent malaise, loss of taste and smell, headache, ears ringing, sometimes a chest discomfort, difficulty breathing. It was largely confined among older sick people in the hospital who went on the mechanical ventilators, basically like recovering from a severe pneumonia. We entered in the COVID-19 vaccines, and most of the world has contracted COVID after they've taken a vaccine. So now long COVID is way worse because they've been loaded with the genetic code for the spike protein. So the spike protein is already in the body, it's already causing inflammation, it's everywhere. Then they get the virus and they get even more total body inflammation. So I think any study on long COVID after the beginning of 2021 should always factor in the vaccine status. The vaccine status is the major cause of our long COVID symptoms at this point in time. It's what I'm observing in my clinical practice. That's what exists in the medical literature right now. So when it's evaluated together, the vaccine is the bigger cause of long COVID or post-COVID than the virus itself.
Mm-hmm. So you call for showing up data. I guess in the very beginning, there were many people, but also authorities and doctors, who initially wanted to see the study situation on the new vaccinations. But they were not given an insight. How is something like this possible? Is it legal?
Well, I can tell you, this went all the way to the Supreme Court of India. And lead barrister Prashant Bhushan presented a case in the Indian Supreme Court and said, listen, we haven't seen the data on the vaccinations in Indian people. We just haven't seen the information. You can't possibly mandate this on this. Bhushan wanted the mandates to be dropped, the vaccine to be pulled off the market. He wanted a lot. In the case, he got down to one thing that he won. He won the Supreme Court decision against mandating the vaccine in India. That was huge. India had zero people mandated to take the shot, because it went all the way to the U.S. The Indian Supreme Court, because they provided no information. And you're right. To this day, the 90-day dossier of what happened after Pfizer was demanded out of a protracted legal battle in the United States, mm-hmm. where Americans wanted to know what the vaccine was doing. Pfizer did not want to show this. They had the data. The U.S. FDA did not want to show the Pfizer data. And finally, the court demanded it. It came out roughly a year after Pfizer had been out, but it had 90 days of what happened from the very first person with Pfizer for 90 days, and it was horrific. We learned that there were 1,223 people who died with Pfizer within a few hours or a few days of taking the shot. Horrific problems in four different areas: cardiovascular, neurologic, thrombotic, and immunologic. It was, the vignettes were striking. Now, Moderna still didn't want to release them, their information recently. It's just been released to be analyzed. Janssen and AstraZeneca never released their information, and then Novavax, the other supplier, didn't release. Why don't the vaccine companies, why do they not want to disclose the data when every other drug approved must disclose their post-marketing data? And they do. But the vaccine companies and the U.S. government and the FDA have specifically tried to block results to the public.
Mm-hmm. And even today, as far as I know, not everything is open now to show. It seems like there are some hidden studies, hidden data that even today we cannot see. We're not allowed to.
Well, you know that's the case because if you go take a vaccine and you ask for the package insert, which is the paper that comes with the vaccine, you're entitled to see that. It should list all the studies and all the side effects. And in fact, the package insert is blank.
Mm-hmm. So, well, some people doubt that the large, well-known pharmaceutical companies that have marketed these vaccines believe in its effectiveness. Since you have much better insights than probably even our media, or at least than I, I want to ask you, is this true? Do the vaccination companies do not believe in the effectiveness of their own vaccination?
It's hard to speak for them. Recently, under oath, in the Australian Parliament, lead Senator Gerard Rennick had a chance to question two Pfizer executives. And they didn't display that they had confidence in their vaccine. And to make matters worse, they disclosed that there were special manufacturing lots for the Pfizer employees. So they didn't go out to vaccine centers or have the general lots. And people are worried because not every batch or lot of vaccine is the same. This has now been shown in the U.S. data as synthesized by Senator Ron Johnson and in a publication from Denmark by Schmeling and colleagues. Schmeling. I had a chance to talk to one of the senior authors, Verbeke Manichi, when I was in Copenhagen recently. And what I learned is that there's three basically risk groups for lots. There's a third of people who took the shots, nothing happens. Not even a sore arm, zero side effects. And it looks like they're not gonna have any side effects. There's just under two thirds who take the shots and they have a moderate sore arm and some minor side effects. And then there's the third group, which is only 4.2% in the Schmeling paper, pretty close to the 7.7% in the CDC VSafe data. Those people get really sick. And they have lots of acute side effects. Fever, nausea, vomiting, chest pain, heart racing, passing out. We believe it's that third batch group that probably gets myocarditis, heart attacks, stroke, blood clots, sudden death. We believe it's probably that group. And the theories are that the manufacturing is so sloppy. The companies don't make their own products. They outsource it to biodefense contractors who are not pharmaceutical companies. So for Moderna, for instance, they outsource to Resilience. They're a biodefense company. They're not a brand name pharmaceutical company. Mm-hmm. So all this is outsourced to military contractors. The vaccines are not inspected, at least in any reports that we can look at in terms of good manufacturing processes. On the Pfizer website, Pfizer says they actually do 40 inspections of each vial, but they've never told us what inspections they are. One of the theories is the vials aren't the same because people have different outcomes depending on what batch they have. And number two, the lipid nanoparticles probably aggregate. So some people probably get a much stronger dose than others. We were told they had to be super cooled at first, and you saw those scenes of cooling. Then we were told that the buffer changed and they don't need cooling. Some of these sit out for a long time, others don't. So there's probably a lot of product variation involved. Mm-hmm. But the shots are not all the same, and I wish everybody was in that first group where nothing happens. We wouldn't be sitting here today if these were safe shots, but they're not. For some people, it's catastrophic, mm-hmm. and sadly, they've lost their lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, the authorities and the governments, they know about these cases. Why do they still promote these risky vaccinations when we know about the side effects?
In the United States, our understanding is that the SARS-CoV-2 outbreak falls under the 2006 PREP Act. The PREP Act was written in the United States by the Health and Human Services Department and the U.S. Congress, saying the United States could be attacked by a biological agent, such as influenza or a SARS virus or Marburg virus. There's a whole list of viruses, and as well as bacteria and fungi, that could threaten our country. And when that occurs, and the declaration occurs that we're under attack, then there are countermeasures. And the countermeasures will be government offerings to people, and they are immune from any forms of liability if something goes wrong. And the contracts to the pharmaceutical companies are non-competitive contracts. The American people don't get to vote on these. There's no vote for anyone. And the money is flowing between treasuries and the pharmaceutical companies all over the world. I anticipate here in Germany, it's a similar setup. Mm-hmm. The vaccines are actually government property. You can't go out and buy one yourself. You can go out and buy some antibiotics if a doctor prescribes it for you, or you could buy a nutraceutical over the counter, but you can't buy a COVID vaccine. It's government property. Mm-hmm. And we're now 3 years into this, and they are not commercially fully licensed. And you know that because you can't buy it. As soon as a product is fully approved by the regulatory agency, you can buy it. But you can't go out and buy a COVID vaccine.
Interesting. Never thought about this. Uh-huh. Well, just when I have you here, just would like to ask you a question. What do you think? What role does the WHO play in the global vaccination debate? What interests do they represent?
The World Health Organization, and it's my interpretation, I've put this in my book, Courage to Face COVID-19, they're playing a role in the biopharmaceutical complex. The biopharmaceutical complex we define in our book I wrote with John Leake as being the WHO, the United Nations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Wellcome Trust, the Gates Foundation, CEPI, Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation. They're a big part of the complex, founded by Gates and WEF, World Economic Forum. And then the regulatory agencies. Here in Europe, it'd be the EMA. In UK, it's the MHRA, South Africa, SAHPRA, Australia, the TGA, United States, is CDC, NIH, FDA, HHS, the Department of State. You know all these agencies are involved because they have statements on their website regarding SARS-CoV-2 and the vaccines. You know they're all involved. Hmm. You know, why would the involvement have to be this extensive? Well, there is a biopharmaceutical complex. Now, the companies, the pharmaceutical companies, they're just the suppliers to the complex. But your question was, what's the role of the WHO? I think they are the head of the complex. The complex has figured out that if they invest in one another, which they are heavily, and if people move around in the complex, they meet every year in Davos, Switzerland, because the World Economic Forum is part of the complex and they're all there, that they can actually really coordinate pandemics and the response. That's really a big part of the complex. It's highly profitable. An example is the Gates Foundation as an NGO invested a few million in BioNTech. They got out billions, millions to billions. That's the investment. You know people are moving in the complex. The last 9 out of 10 U.S. FDA commissioners, they work in the complex now. Scott Gottlieb, former FDA commissioner, works for Pfizer. The person who followed him, Stephen Hahn, works for a flagship, the venture capital firm for Moderna. Ben Tam, the lead public health administrator for England, just joined Moderna. The lead Danish public health official just joined Moderna. Rick Bright, who is in the White House in pandemic response, he works for the Rockefeller Foundation. Jamie Farrar, who worked for the Wellcome Trust, now works for the WHO as a chief scientist. So this complex is a working syndicate. They're in the business of pandemics and they're in the business of vaccines. And boy, they want more. They want more. Do you know Tedros, who leads the WHO, Bill Gates, Anthony Fauci, who played a prominent role, now retired former NIH division chief, and then new vaccine frontman Peter Hotez in Houston. They all say with great enthusiasm that there's going to be another pandemic and it's going to be way worse than COVID. Why would they be so enthused about another pandemic? Because they're in the complex and the complex is in the business of doing this now. It's big money. It's a lot of power. It's world control.
Well, I remember that you faced them very early. So when they brought these things out, you were pretty open and direct, and you were warned from these vaccinations and even this complex. You made it open even from parliaments. When you first publicly questioned these vaccinations, What was your experience?
I have to tell you, I've never seen this in my life. You know, I was a former professor of medicine, the most published person in my field in the world in history before COVID. I was well known across Europe. I had lectured at most of your major medical centers in Berlin and in Frankfurt, all over Germany. I've lectured at the European Medicine Agencies, at the New York Academy of Sciences. To give you an example, an average professor of medicine here in Germany would have 25 listings in the National Library of Medicine. Those would be the accomplishments, the research accomplishments, and the manuscripts. I have over 680, not 25, 680. I have over 70 in COVID-19. I'm one of the most authoritative people in medicine in the world in history. And can you imagine, instead of McCullough Protocol being accepted and widely adopted, I received censorship and reprisal. And as I did more research and still trying to bring the world solutions, I was slammed. I was slammed by the medical media. I was castigated on my Wikipedia page, which I can't control. It's basically just wide open biographical defamation. I was sued by a major health system. I've been forced out of 2 jobs for no reason, forced out of 2 editorships, again, for no reason. My major medical society was dissolved with no courtesy call, no phone call, no board vote. Due process has been completely ignored on any of this. No one's actually faced me face to face, sat down with me like this, and said, Dr. McCullough, I disagree with you on treating COVID, or I disagree with you on the vaccines, and I want to tell you that face to face. No one has had the courage to look me in the eye and just have a discussion. I've testified 3 times in the US Senate. Invitation to all the senators, advanced invitation to the public health response teams, all the officials. No one will show up to face me or doctors in my circles. Mm-hmm.
They just try to quiet you, that your voice will not come up. This is what, to hide your...
Pretty hard to do, don't you think? I mean, I went on Joe Rogan. I set, you know, all the records for his podcast, even eclipsing what, you know, Elon Musk ever said or did on his show. I've been on Daystar, largest Christian broadcasting network in the United States and across the world, with reruns. The estimates are each one of our sets and shows have reached 1.7 billion people, 4 times over. So every time there's an attempt to censor or suppress the truth, it amplifies. The signal gets bigger.
Hmm. Well, I'm very thankful that you do this and that you open even data for the people. Like, for me, it's very difficult to get this data. But if you would know beforehand what they would do with you when you bring out your publications against the vaccination, would you have done it anyway?
Oh, for sure. I would do it again and again and again, because as a doctor, I took an oath to do no harm. My role in this is to preserve life and fight disease. The vaccines cause disease and they take human lives. The vaccines have never been shown to have a significant clinical benefit. They don't effectively block COVID-19, particularly with the modern strains. The most recent booster that's just approved in the United States, there are no human data to review. So there's no evidence that it would even work in a human being. And the vaccines have never been shown to reduce transmission. And the CDC directors and others came out and said they don't reduce transmission. And they've never been shown to reduce hospitalization and death or reduce severity in prospective double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trials or any valid observational studies. So the vaccines have a huge risk and almost no benefit whatsoever. So as a doctor, what I would recommend to the next patient in front of me is what as I would recommend to the public as a public figure. I would do it all again, for sure. My contributions have been substantial. Not only have been, very importantly, the very first published and most widely used treatment protocol in principle in the world, in history, which probably saved tens of millions of lives and spared hundreds of millions of hospitalizations. That's a big accomplishment. It's the biggest accomplishment in my career. But now I have published the first peer-reviewed paper and approach to detoxify the body of the spike protein after vaccination. And now that's been published in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons. And I'm very proud about getting these scientific advances out and let the public benefit.
Mm-hmm. So they were unable to silence you. Because even nowadays, you speak in courts and in front of members of many parliaments in the United States, just like in the European Union. I know recently you were here, and I think in Belgium you spoke for the parliament. What are the reactions of the audience? What do the people say?
September 13th, 2023 was a historic day. It was in the European Parliament in Strasbourg, so close to on the border of Germany. And it was a riveting session. It was chaired by Christine Anderson, German member of European Parliament. And there was a core group of parliamentarians there, MEPs were there. Five legal presenters and then four scientific presenters, of which I was the lead. But the distillation of all the presentations and the data, and people were listening, were two things. Boiled down to two things. Number one, pull the COVID vaccines off the European market. They're not safe to be given. Not a single person is safe receiving another injection. A current one or even future boosters, get them off the market. It's been a failed experiment. And then two, withdraw from the World Health Organization. World Health Organization, the Pandemic Treaty Alliance, and the International Health Regulations, they are not in the public benefit for citizens, for countries, member nations, you know, bloc countries or bloc unions like the European Union. They should withdraw. The WHO can't help you and me in our healthcare. And the WHO aspires to have dominion over all plants, animals, and humans. It is a global power grab that doesn't have the world's best interest at heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would like to have a look with you to the future. So what do we expect? I mean, can you see anything changing in the countries around the world, or especially in the United States, since the pandemic broke out? Is there any major changes?
Oh, the public has really changed. Do you remember back in 2020, everything was shut down, people wearing masks, social distancing, people weren't seeing their family members, everyone distrusted themselves? Dramatic change now. I've just traveled across Europe, crowded trains, crowded airplanes, everything's back to usual, hustling, bustling. The virus is still there. People are still getting COVID, but people aren't afraid of it. It's like the common cold now. The virus is mutated. It's very mild. The leading strains, by the way, are the Eris strain, EG5, and the FL1.5 strain. The most recent booster is off target. It's targeted against the XBB 1.5 strain. Even if antibodies are raised against EG5, it's almost certainly not going to be worthwhile, and certainly not safer to take. So I'm not recommending new boosters at all. And people have learned how to defend themselves. They've learned about virucidal nasal sprays and washes, the importance of aspirin and vitamin D and vitamin C and other nutraceuticals, healthy diet, fitness. You look like you're somebody who, you know, would do great, you know, if the next pandemic came along. And if it does, we're going to use the same, it's probably going to be a virus, and we're going to use the same principles, at least the first part of the McCullough Protocol, we will. But the sentiment has changed. The recent Kaiser Family Foundation survey, end of June, early July, published on their website, Kaiser Family Foundation. A third of Americans believe the vaccines have killed thousands of patients. A third of Americans. People are withdrawing from mass vaccination. They're protesting. You know, there's been protests all over. And in the United States, or even jurisdictions, or even some states that would just ban the use of the vaccines. If the federal government won't do it, there may be local jurisdictions that will do it. But I think people have learned an important lesson. It's not worth it to take a shot and get a blood clot or heart damage or die in order to keep a job for 6 months. That 6 months of employment's not worth it. And then take another shot and another shot. It's just not worth it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm glad that we have people like you who spread the data, who spread truth and speaking about these facts without being too offensive to judge the people but to say clearly and so what is right and what is wrong. Now, since you do this in the parliaments as well, what kind of mindset do you recognize in the parliaments? Do you think the world will ever be like it was before the pandemic?
The world has changed for good. No, it's changed. Remember, most of the parliamentarians, most of senators and congressmen, they've taken the shot. Most have. Most doctors have taken the shot. Most people that you see in your schools and churches and employers, they've taken the shot. They all are going to have to come to an understanding of what they've done to their body. When they evaluate the data, it is inherent that there will be concern about one's self. There will be concern about one's future. There's concerns about family members who have taken the vaccine. Everything has changed. And the vaccine has divided families. Some family members don't want to take it, others do. Now there's a difficult conversation. Since when does a medicinal product cause family discord? No, the vaccine program has changed the world forever. There is a fraction of people in the world, it's probably a third of people who are breathing a sigh of relief. Oh, thank the Lord I didn't take one of these vaccines. I did not take the COVID vaccine. I would not take one. I'm not worried about myocarditis or blood clots or cardiac arrest, but I'm really worried about people in my circles who did take the shots, because every day we hear about cardiac arrests, blood clots, immune complications. It keeps going and going and going. So yeah, it's a personal, now it's a personal psychological struggle to overcome the fear of what people did to their bodies. And then they're trying to make legislative decisions for their countries. Do you see? Just like a doctor who took it, they're having fear about themselves. And then now they've pushed it with their patients. Their patients are having problems. You can imagine how hard it is to get on the right side of this and say, listen, we've just made a giant mistake.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, when this all came up and the society was split, and even as you say, family was split, even the doctors were at once, they had two sides. Some choose this way, other this way. But now you're not only a doctor and a scientist, but you're also a Christian. Would you wish that the churches had taken a clearer position on the pandemic? That they would have risen their voice in the beginning?
Well, why would a church at the very top of the church advocate for experimental, genetic, unproven, unsafe, ineffective vaccines? How could any church at the top do that? I mean, that's an astounding observation. So you could take the top of the Roman Catholic Church. Why would the Pope ever advocate for vaccination? Why not be neutral? So listen, we're a church and this is an emerging pandemic. We'll let other experts figure it out. Why would they take a position on this? They have to answer that question. Do you know there's some people who took the vaccine because their religious leaders told them it was a good thing to do?
Can you imagine?
Can you imagine the complicity, the guilt, the shame, the remorse within the church? Within the church. There's not a single major denomination, at least among Christian denominations, that actually said, no, it's a bad thing. At the top, all the churches were complicit in mass vaccination. Baptists, Methodists, Latter-day Saints, Adventists, more and more. But then there were large groups underneath that said, no, this is not a good thing. You know, in the United States, you know what some of the strongest churches that did not close down during the mandates and did not advocate for the vaccines? They were non-denominational. Non-denominational. Many times evangelical. I've met with some of these non-denominational churches and their pastors. Isn't it interesting?
Indeed.
So to be non-denominational, almost to be independent, if you will, of an orthodoxy, gave them more freedom to make decisions and not have undue influence on their, you know, on their congregations. It's a stunning observation.
It was interesting. I remember when the churches, I thought they should avoid these scientific standpoints for a church. What I would wish that the church makes a clear point how we handle each other when this pandemic is there. And so I thought maybe you can grab this point and speak about this, how to love each other, even if he has a other opinion than you or other.
Yeah. Well, most religions have in it respect for self, respect for bodily autonomy. And most religions, remember, a religion or a denomination is a framework to understand their spirituality. That's really what it is. And so we're largely born into our religions. We really are. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to understand our spirituality. Most of them have as a tenet that the human body is the creation from God. It's a God-given creation. Mm-hmm. And the vaccines have clearly come to represent desecration of God's creation. And the church leaders at the top have advocated for desecration of God's own creation. They're going to have the hardest time coming to reckon. We haven't even started the church discussions yet. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what religious historians, theologians will write about?
Interesting question, yeah. Well, yeah. Well, since our time is running, I would like to ask a last question. Well, with the next wave of pandemics already becoming at the horizon, I ask myself, what can we do to be prepared? I mean, should I store medicines at home and masks and other equipment? What will you do?
I can tell you as a doctor, but this would apply to people who are in other fields and other endeavors, to trust your own independent instincts. If something doesn't make sense, trust your instincts, number one. Trust your common sense. And then number two, be ready. There are papers published on this that say, you know, people who are saying there's going to be a next pandemic, and there is research funding the development of more infectious biological threats. It's a big business. One of these gets out of the lab, yeah, there will be another pandemic. It's almost always, if it's going to infect the world, it's almost always going to be a virus, and it'll be a respiratory virus. It's not going to be contact by contact. It probably won't be bacteria or fungi. So if we're back to a respiratory virus, everybody should be ready with nasal sprays and gargles. Everybody. Scope or Listerine we have in the United States works fine. Commercially, one can buy Cofix RX or Clear or Immune Mist or Colloidal Silver. Those are all fine commercial products. Or just make a homemade solution of some iodine. Just a bottle of iodine in a few drops will save a lot of lives. And as soon as one becomes sick with this new virus, to spray the iodine spray up the nose, sniff it back and spit it out. Should not burn or sting. Should be very comfortable doing this and gargle. 30-second gargles. That will probably save more lives and reduce spread than anything else. Masks can't stop the spread. Hand sanitizers can't. But the nasal sprays and gargles are the most important thing people should understand. They should have a little stockpile of aspirin, anti-inflammatories like naproxen or ibuprofen, acetaminophen for fever control, vitamin D, vitamin C, for instance. There are some generally antiviral supplements. One of them is curcumin. It's probably good to have curcumin on hand. Another one is a Chinese herb. It's called artemisinin. It's derived from a plant called wormwood. And be ready. Have these ready. You never want to call somebody saying, I'm sick with COVID and I don't have anything at home. No, because they're going to go out to the store and spread it around. So everybody should have a supply at home. I don't travel without an iodine spray, for instance, and a gargle. I have it with me right now. Because if I started to feel a little bit sick, I would do it immediately. The first hour is most important.
Great. Well, thank you very much. This was a most interesting interview for me.
Wow, thanks for having me. So do we have an iceberg ahead?
Oh, yeah, I think there is one.
I think we can agree on that. Well, thank you so much for having me on the program.
Well, it was great to have such well-known scientist among us. And thank you for sharing a bit of your wisdom so that we could grab something. And maybe, I guess, we were all blessed by this interview.
Thank you.
So just let me say thank you very much for being with us. And see you next time on Iceberg Ahead. God bless you.